water molecule, for example. Okay. So if you want to describe that microscopically, even though the building blocks are simple, it would require quite a lot of analysis using tools that at one point in the 20th century were considered fairly exotic. So here, it's kind of similar. You know, the models that actually achieve modelized civilization, well, the building blocks of those are fairly simple, right? And I've shown you like one model, which you just specify by, you know, two five-dimensional charge vectors, right? Like this historic construction. And once you have that, basically, in principle, everything is straightforward. Only the analysis requires, you know, some techniques in some geometrical techniques, and you know, a lot of things that have been developed the past decades in string theory that appear there and so on. But you know, this is just how science progresses. Like techniques become more advanced than what's exotic at one time is standard 10 years later. Okay. So anyway, I wanted to try to give you an idea about what goes in. All right. So are there actually questions about the last lecture? So let me quickly recap what we had last time. So you learned basically how to construct a huge family or a huge class of Calabi-Yau prefolds, which are suitable for supersymmetric string compactifications. Right. So so we learned how to construct Calabi-Yau prefolds. Okay, so one example of such a construction was our example 2, right, which involved the fields x1, x3, x4, to x5 with u1 charges, which are auxiliary u1 charges, right? They're not physical. There's no physical gauge symmetry here. It's a mathematical construction, if you want. Okay, so these charges, which means we have this constraint on the axis, it's a psi for some positive psi, which determines the size of the historic variety. And then within this space, we considered a hypersurface S, or let me call it X, because it's actually the letter that I use to denote Calabi-Yau in the general story. And this satisfies the equation x5 squared equals h8, x1, x2, x3, x4. And in fact, up to coordinates redefinitions, this is the most general homogeneous polynomial of degree 8 you can write down. So you could say, well, how about the linear term in x5 combined with the fourth order polynomial in the x1, x2, x3, x4? Well, then you can always absorb by the shift of x5 by this polynomial. Well, that's something you have to look at, well, case by case, at least with the techniques I've given you. But in this case, it will be compact, right? Because obviously this space is compact. But in general, for random charge assignments, it will not. I mean, if there are negative and positive charges, then you know you could have non-compact directions. And this will always give, because it's like it's a polynomial equation inside a compact manifold. So that, you know, however, it can become singular. So for special values of the coefficients of this H8, right? So in general, this has like a whole bunch of deformations. The manifold can develop like conifold singularities and those things. Like they can be like sort of double points and sort of pinch points. Yeah, but and those are often associated with interesting physics as well. Okay, so note that, so you could now try to count the number of polynomial deformations of this thing. So how many is that? Well, that's, so it's basically the number of coefficients of this guy here, right? And so this is a degree 8 polynomial. And if you think about it for a minute, you see that the degree 8 homogeneous polynomial of 4 variables has 8 plus 3 choose 3 coefficients. Okay, think about that. And this equals 149. Okay, so this will give you 149 complex structure deformation moduli of the Columbian. Okay. In this case, there will be one Kähler modulus, one size modulus given by this psi, and 149 complex structure moduli. Okay. Maybe to be sure that everybody is with me, like, so I got the question yesterday. Well, you know, what the hell is a Calabian? And you will explain or something like. So let me just in 2 minutes, for those who don't know, briefly say what it is. So, well. Behind my curtain, if you want. Right. You can define it as a manifold that, or a Kähler manifold, so I'll say in a moment what that is. Kähler manifold, which allows a Ricci flat metric. Okay, which so it allows vacuum solution of the Einstein equations without any cosmological constant. Okay. Now, that's good, of course, because that means that the Calabi-Yau manifold X can indeed appear as a solution to the leading order supergravity equations of motion, which are the low energy effective equations of motion coming out of string theory. Right. So this. Okay, so that should not come as a surprise that indeed it allows the Ricci flat metric, because we claim that it is indeed a solution. By leading order, I mean becoming increasingly good as an approximation of the exact string equations of motion when the volume becomes larger and larger. Okay, so that's one possible definition. Now, you maybe don't know what a Kähler manifold is, so let me say Kähler manifolds. Well, Kähler manifolds as a metric that looks like this. So it's a complex manifold, always, in which you can put complex coordinates, zi. In this case, for the Calabi-Yau threefold, I goes from 1 to 3. Okay. In our case. Okay, and the metric is of this particular form, so no d, z, I, d, z, j, 2 points, for example. That's the content of this equation. Okay, so the metric is of this form, and now you can define something that's called the Kähler form as just from this metric, simply by replacing d, z, I, d, z bar, j bar, by d, z, I, wedge, d, z bar, j bar. So this becomes a 2-form. Okay. You can always do the mechanism of this form. And now we say we have a Kähler manifold if J is closed. Okay. And this is equivalent with the fact that locally there exists a Kähler potential, a so-called Kähler potential, such that the metric can be derived from that. Okay. So I'm sure to most of you this is a familiar notion from n equals 1 supersymmetry, n equals 1 supergravity in 4 dimensions, where supersymmetry requires scalar manifolds to be Kähler manifolds. And so that perhaps gives you one way of looking at these things. So why do we need a Kähler manifold to have something supersymmetric? Well, so if you look, for example, at E3 brains, which are space filling, but point like in the Calabi-Yau, then they will feel just the Calabi-Yau metric, it's the leading order, right? But this thing is supersymmetric, so you expect that it's described by a four-dimensional n equals one supersymmetric theory. So the target manifold of the degrees of freedom of this point in Calabi-Yau should be given for supersymmetric. Okay, so that's sort of where this comes from. So the combination of this with allowing rigid left metric makes the thing a Calabi-Yau manifold. Okay. All right. Now the actual Calabi-Yau metric, the rigid left metric, is, well, in general, you cannot find it in any closed form. So if you start from this equation and you just took the metric that's induced on the surface from the ambient, like flat metric on C5, say, right, you just reduce, well, that will not give you a Calabi-Yau metric. Okay. But that's okay, because for many purposes, you really don't need to. And in particular, this is thanks to a theorem of Yau, which was conjectured by Calabi, hence the name, that basically what this flat background, what this flat ambient metric does is, well, it can induce some scalar form, right? And then this Yau theorem says that there will always exist a unique Ricci flat metric that has a scalar form, this, you know, flat scalar form, basically, up to an exact part. Okay. Now, of course, this will still depend on the choice of context section model and the choice of psi, right? But those then parameterize them at the same time, just the set of all possible Ricci flat metrics on this Calabi-Yau, and that's how they arise as moduli and in low energy. Okay. So is this clear? No? Sufficiently clear? So now we have this set of Calabi-Yau manifolds. So now you could try to just turn on fluxes on this thing. And as I explained in this general story, this will generally induce a potential for at least some of the moduli. And if you say, OK, fine, this will stabilize the moduli. However, if you just turn on fluxes, then all of the energy contributions from the fluxes are in fact positive, right? I mean, these are just magnetic fluxes. They contribute positively to the energy density, which is classical objects, right? So the potential, which before turning on fluxes, we know is just exactly flat and zero, right? So these are the moduli, right? That thing will now, if you turn on fluxes, it will become something like this. Well, that's all positive contributions, which, by the general argument, we know that in the decompactification limits, and we call this maybe rho to remind you of this discussion that we had, goes to zero. Right. You'll get something that looks like this, that has a runaway direction. Okay. So if you just turn on fluxes, you only get positive contributions that become vanishing for rho to infinity, so you automatically get a runaway direction, and you don't stabilize anything. Okay. So this is consistent with what I said in the beginning. In order to really get a minimum, you also need some negative contribution to the potential. Okay. Without it, it won't work. And this negative contribution, is provided in string theory by something that goes under the name of Orienti folds. Okay. this will exactly provide us these negative energy contributions. So how does this work? What is an Orientti fault? Well, so let's first say, just consider a string background in geometry. With a Z2 symmetry, some Z2 isometry. Just symmetry. Okay. So, for example, just flat, non compact 10 dimensional space, provide you with an obvious example. So flat R19. Okay, well, there's many Z2 isometries there, but one you could. Take, so let's take as coordinates on this space x mu, where mu goes from 0 to 9. So then you can take, for example, x1 goes to minus x1, and x mu remains the same for all mu different from 1. So you just flip the sign of one of the coordinates. Okay. This is an isometry. So in other words, this is x1, and this is whatever, some other coordinates, then just mirroring around x1. Something like this. Okay. Now you can look at more sophisticated backgrounds. So you can, for example, add D-brains. Okay. So what a D-brain, let me remind you, is just like some defect in space, some subspace, on which strings are allowed to end. Right. There are several of them. Brings them stretch between them, stuff like that. So you could add to this flat space, for example, some system of D-brains which respects the Z2 symmetry that you've chosen. So for example, you could put one here and one there, like parallel, or could by taking crossing like this, or could perhaps take it. This is also invariant under this too. Yeah. Those are all possibilities. Okay. All right. So now we just have this background with the Z2 symmetry. Now we're going to gauge this Z2 symmetry. We're going to declare it to be the gauge symmetry. So that whole thing becomes a redundant description. But we're not just going to do a standard geometrical identification. What we're going to do is we're going to identify any string state or string states with their orientation reversed Z2 image. Okay. And so identify is as in gauge equivalence. Okay. So for example, we're going to identify some open string oriented like this, lying on this side, with this thing. Okay, so you mirror it, then you would get something that's oriented like this, right? If you just mirror this, you get something that's oriented like this. But now you also flip the orientation, so you get something oriented like that. Okay, that's one possibility. Now, the fixed locus here, yeah. So this is x1 equals 0, remember? This, in general, the fixed locus of such an orientifold Z2 is called an O-plane, an orientifold plane. And in this case, more precisely, it's called an OA plane. Why? Because it has dimension 9. Okay. Well, it refers to the number of spatial dimensions. So just like the B-brains, the A-brain would be a D-brain with 8 spatial dimensions, an OA plane is a fixed point locus of the Z2 with 8 spatial dimensions. Okay, this is an OA plane. Now, so here we have, I've looked at the closed string state just away from the O plane. Just gets back here again. Now, you could also look inside the O plane. Yeah, so that's. Imagine you have here this O-plane, right? This mirrors in the board size. But you could look at a closed string state in there, something like that. Now this gets identified with the Z2 image of it, but since it's the fixed point locus, the Z2 image is just string itself, but then with the opposite orientation. So this string oriented in this way gets identified with that string. Okay? So in a sense, this string is now unoriented because the states which correspond to this orientation are identified with the states with the opposite orientation. And in the presence of D-brains, you have similar things. So for example, for first case, so let me now use a different color for the string of the brain. So for example, if we have an open string like this, and this gets identified with the states. Well, this is invariant under Z2, you think it's not, but now the orientation gets flipped. So this becomes something like that. And you could also have just some open string like that, which gets mapped to this thing here. Orientation reversed.
I have a question. Why doesn't the open string stretching between the two brains get an orientation reversed already under Z2?
So I've been a little bit talking about that. So the more precise statement is that x1 t phi. So in general, you parameterize the string by some time coordinate and some spatial coordinate phi, which in the case of the closed string goes from 0 to 2 pi, and you periodically identify edges. So that's a closed string. For the open string, phi goes from 0 to pi. And so then the Z2 acts like this. So x1 t phi goes to minus x1 t 2 pi minus phi. OK. Okay, well, I was getting confused about this last night, and I thought I. Let me think about that, and maybe we can sort it out at the end. I thought I'd convince myself in the end that it was like this, but maybe it was just the late hour that did. Yeah. Okay, anyhow, this is the idea. So, Yeah, because this doesn't make sense. This should be pi minus pi, then I guess. Pretty open string. But then this should be the other way around. I don't know. That doesn't seem quite right. Anyway. Let's in any case, the one of the consequences if you quantize these strings in these backgrounds, the identical backgrounds, is that you find that O planes are in fact charged in a similar way as D brains are charged. Okay. So an O plane, O P plane in general, has dP charge, so right, and moreover, it has negative tension. Okay. So it's a non-dynamical object, so it's okay that it has negative tension. There's like no fluctuations living on this thing, because something with negative tension that's dynamical, like a D-brain is, would lead to serious trouble. But in any case, it acts as a negative energy source. So really, you know, if you wrote down some supergravity or some gravity solution to the equation of motion, you see that it's like some object that has gravitational repulsion and all kinds of weird things. Okay. But it's there. So in our example, more concretely, going back to our example, so there, maybe it's still, oh yeah, it's up there. Okay. So there we can take as our Z2 symmetry, x5 goes to minus x5. Clearly, it's a symmetry of that equation and everything else. So then we have an O plane at the fixed point locus of the symmetry, which is an O7 as x5 equals 0. Why is it an O7 and not an O8 as we had there? Well, remember, x5 is a complex coordinate. Right? So we're flipping the sign of a complex coordinate. Okay. So x5 equals 0 is a complex co-dimension 1. So that's an O7 plane. Now, I said O planes have charge. And in this case, this O7 has D7 charge. And in general, it has D7 charge density equal to minus 8 times that the charge density that a D7 brain would have. So it's minus 8 in D7 brain units. Okay. So in other words, what does this mean? That means that this charge is completely cancelled locally, right? There's just no charge density remaining. If you put 4 D7s plus their 4 images, plus their 4 Z2 image D7s, right? So it gives a total of 8 on top of our O7, which is given by the equation x5 equals 0. Okay? So then the D7 grain charge is completely cancelled. Now, adding the Z7 range to cancel the charge is not only a possibility, it's a necessity in this case. We really have to. Okay. And the reason is that we're working on a compact manifold. Okay. And so on a compact manifold, the total charge of all the sources that you have inside has to add up to zero. So the total E7 charge that we have must be zero. Okay. So you can sort of picture this. So we have like some compact box. Imagine sites are identified, compact space. We have some O7 in there. Yeah. Well, that would be bad because, you see, we get flux lines, charge flux lines coming out of here, but they have nowhere to go to, okay? So you really have to cancel this off, this charge, by adding for the seven brains. Sorry. Let me draw a separate picture for that. So this is bad. This is good. So you have the O7, 4D7s, and their images. So this would be here, one, the other one there, there, and there, something like that. Then the flux lines do have places to go. So just stuff like that. You just get dipole things. Okay? So this is good. Okay. So one possibility is indeed to put 4D7s and their images, so 8D7s, coincident on top of the O7, but this is not the most general possibility. We can also do something slightly more complicated. So, why is minus 8? No, I didn't explain that. That is, you have to do the string combination. So it depends on the dimension as well. Okay, so the D7 charge density is minus 8. The O7 charge is minus 8 in D7 units. The O6 is minus 4 in D6 units. The O5 is minus 2, and so it goes down. But this comes out of a string computation, or a string diagram. I couldn't find some good intuitive way why this is. Okay. So here, well, okay. So this equation here, if you want, has U1 charge in our toric geometry sense, U1 charge Q, which is equal to 4, right? Because X5 has weight 4 there, has charge 4. So in general, we can add a D7 given by some equation, D7, of all the x's equals 0, with the charge of this polynomial equal to 4 times the charge of this polynomial, right, which is 16. Okay. So in a special degeneration limit of such a polynomial, you get just 4 coincident brains on top of that. Yeah. But more generically, you can do some smooth deformations as long as this is a degree 16 homogeneous polynomial in x1 to x5, you're okay. Plus, of course, then it's oriented fault image, which will be described by BD7, x1, and so on, minus x5. Okay. So now, you can actually see that the most general such polynomial can be written in this form. So for the D7, this will become some degree 16 polynomial. Let's call this eta 16, x1 to x4 plus x5 times some degree 12 polynomial x4 equals 0. You could have like terms that go like x5 squared, but you can eliminate those by this equation, right? So then it becomes something of this form again, right? So this is the most general possibility. There's a term without x5 and a term linear in x5. No, or a polynomial without it. And then the image is just exactly the same, but with a minus sign. Okay? Now, in fact, there's this even slightly more general deformation. You can combine these two and recombine them up to a certain extent, not like a complete full recombination as you could do in the absence of identical planes, but still. So there's still a somewhat bigger class of possibilities, but okay. Sorry, say it again? Yeah. Yeah. So you could have an x5 cubed times psi 4, right? But you see, then you can eliminate. So in x5 cubed, you write x5 cubed as x5 squared times x5. Then you eliminate x5 squared using this equation. And then you're back in this case. Yeah, so that's it. Yeah. Well, maybe I should. So, the interest of being correct. So, if you can just multiply these equations, that will give you the combination of a D7 and its image. So, you get something that looks like eta squared equals, sorry, minus x5 squared psi equals zero, psi squared equals zero. Yeah, just multiply this with this minuses. And then there's, in fact, still deformation you're allowed to do, and that is just something that goes like eta squared minus x5 squared times some degree 24, arbitrary degree 24. So, but this turns out to be the most general deformation. Okay, but this corresponds to sort of reattaching the brain and its image away from your identical form. We get big brain recombination. Okay. And something very similar holds for example 3. Okay. So why do I go through this effort? Well, this just allows you now to really read off the D7 deformation moduli. So the D7 moduli are just the coefficients of this equation. Okay, so you could, if you want, you can count the deformation moduli for yourself, and you'll find that there is 3,728 inequivalent deformations. That's a lot of deformations. Okay. So, recapping so far, we needed negative energy sources, so we had to introduce EO7. Tadpole cancellation, charge cancellation, required us to introduce a D7. Okay. Made the system more complicated, but in a way it's not that bad, because as you will see in Gary Shiu's lectures, D-brains are actually, you know, well, they, in fact, two theories, they carry, or they can carry the standard model gauge, various gauge units, hidden sectors, just everything of particle physics sits in the D-brain sector. So the fact that we're forced to introduce the D7 brains is a good thing, except for the fact that, of course, we have now more moduli to stabilize, many more than we had before. Okay. But so that's something that will be covered by Gary. However, it's not the end of the story. So, because when we thought it couldn't get any worse, it actually gets worse, because another funny property of string theory is that the curvature that exists on the D7 brains and the O7s, so just the curvature of D7s and O7s, right? So in this case, unlike brains maybe in flat space, these are curved manifolds. Well, this curvature carries charge. Okay. Carries D3 charge. Okay, again, this comes out of a detailed computation of string theory, and it wasn't realized actually until like late 90s. But it's true, and it's confirmed from various dual pictures and so on. So it carries D3 brain charge. In fact, you can compute exactly how much D3 brain charge it carries. So let me call the total D3 brain charge carried by these O7s and D7s, and call it minus L, because it will turn out to be negative. And, well, there's a formula for that. Let me just give it for completeness, because it's not completely essential. So it's actually given by the Euler characteristic, chi, D07 by 6, plus, well, some sort of a modified Euler characteristic, D7 divided by 24. Okay, I'm just giving this for completeness. So once you can compute this topological property, the Euler characteristic, the most basic topological invariant, then you can compute the free brain charge. Okay. Now, and this again, this can be done in this setting by standard techniques. So this is not a problem. Either you run it yourself or you go knock on the door of your mathematics neighbor. In any case, in example two, this gives L equals 944, and for number three, L is 17. And this is kind of typical for all these oriented poles you construct in this way. For the simplest examples, like these D3 tadpoles, they all lie in the second millennium, basically. Okay, so that means, again, we have uncancelled charge, right? Again, we have this problem, but now the D3 brain charge. So what do we have to do? Well, the cheap way to get rid of it, so it's negative, right? It's negative D3 brain charge. So what do you do? You just add D3 brains to soak up this charge. So that means you must introduce, well, in example A, in example one, 972 D3s plus their images, right? Those are Z2 images. 972 is half 1944. And in second case, sorry, this was example two, example three. And in second case, 852 D3s and their C2 images. Okay. Once we've done that, though, yes.
What avoids the system to, like, the B3, the D3 brain and the B3 brain not to
annihilate? Well, okay, so you. Yeah, it's a good question. So, well, first off, the D3 brain charge here is sort of this is like D7, and so it's sort of spread out over the D7. So it's like some anti D3 brain charge spread out over the D7 brain due to the curvature. Right, so this is not mobile, and then the D3s appear here. It's point-like things. So it's not that you have D3s and anti-D3 particles which would clearly annihilate. And, well, you would still think that that, well, okay, there's negative charge here, and there's a positive charge there, so why don't they just move there and you know, annihilate? But, so this turns out not to be the case. The reason being that, well, okay, so well, the system is more complicated than this simple picture suggests. So there's more forces than just you know, electrostatic-like interactions, right? There's also gravity in this system, if the curvature. That is right. Yes. Yeah. So what are the balancing forces? It has to be, so it turns out that this system is actually supersymmetric, so there cannot be any force. But what's the balancing force? Yeah, well, it must have to do with the curvature of the space because, well, okay, you say gravity is attractive, but this is a compact manifold, right? So in which direction is it going to attract? It's not clear. Okay, like, you know, like some highly curved thing. also, there is, well, for example, there is this O7, okay, which is gravitationally repulsive, okay, and so it must be then, although I don't think I've ever seen any detailed computation that really shows that this cancellation works at the level of sort of, you know, intuitive forces. But it must be then that it's this curvature that exactly cancels this what you would think is an naive attraction. Yeah. Maybe there's other, well, yeah, this is sort of the best I can come up with for the moment. You could, of course, say, well, you know, let's just eliminate all these complications of curvature and complex spaces. Let's just look at flat space and debray it in there. But then the problem is, you see, the curvature disappears of these brains, so they don't have any induced charge. Yeah. And indeed, well, you could look at a non-supersymmetric brain configuration flat space, which is curved, and you could like make it curved and like, I don't know, it will oscillate up and down or whatever. Then whenever it curves, it will get locally induced charge, and so you would get this attraction, definitely. But then it's not supersymmetric. So, yeah. It's a good question, you know, I've pondered it. This is the best I can call it for the moment. Somebody else maybe has a better. Yeah. I give it as homework to myself. Ah. Erase this one. Okay. Right. So in summary, what's our situation here? So how many moduli do we have now? So note we, yeah. Well, as I said, or as I was alluding to, we have a supersymmetric system here, right? And we know that the charge is canceled, right? So we have what is called RR charge, RR tadpole cancellation. And as a consequence of supersymmetry, this also implies that the positive and negative energy contributions exactly cancel. Okay, so the total charge is zero, and the total tension or the total energy density as a result of supersymmetry will also be zero. Okay. So we have indeed a compactification to flat R13 with an exactly zero potential, and a whole lot of modulus. How many moduli? Well, there is 149, remember, from the complex fracture deformations. Right? It's deformations of this H8 defined polynomial. Then we had 3,729 D7 moduli. This was from deformation of our defining equation, eta squared minus x5 squared chi to 0. Okay, so this you can also check if you want. Plus 972 D3 brains, which each have 3 moduli, right? We can move them around in space because, as I just not explained very well, they don't feed any force. And, well, then we have one, so this is for the D3s. And then we have one from the complexified dilaton, so it's from like some axiom plus I over G string. It's called the axiom dilaton. You always have that in type 2B. If you don't know what these things are, don't worry, it's just one modulus, who cares, right? And then there's one more, which is Taylor modulus, right? Which was psi that we had up there. In the defining equation. In the D-term constraint, if you want. It was psi theory, which is getting this. All right? So this is something of order 7,000 moduli. So let's fix it. It's a daunting task, so. But turning on fluxes, according to the general story I gave, will lift some of the moduli because the energy induced depends on this moduli. And there's more precisely three kinds of fluxes. There is RR freeform flux, Ramon freeform flux, F3. It doesn't matter if you don't know what it is, but this is just some generalized magnetic flux. It's a three-form, which is a gauge field strength, if you want, of a two-form potential. And the number of flux quanta associated to that equals the number of three cycles on X. And then again, by standard geometrical techniques, you can compute. And so in example, in our example 2, very remarkable throughout, this is 100. No, it's not right. This is 300. I'm sorry. Okay. Then there is something which goes under the name of NSNS, freeform flux. Okay, there's also other string theory which we will denote by H3, which is the field strength of the two-form potential which couples to the string world sheet. Again, the number of components, number of flux quanta equals number of free cycles. And again, in our second example, say this will be 300. Okay, so we see we're in the range of fluxes that we sort of start to expect. We can generate discrete chira which are sufficiently fine to get cosmological constants equal or much less even than the one we observe by this general statistical argument that I gave in the first lecture. And then, finally, there is world volume U1 flux. Okay, this is just standard magnetic flux. Okay, so you have just a U1 gauge field that lives on these 7 brains, it turns out. And the D7 brain has a whole bunch of non-trivial 2 cycles for which you can turn on fluxes. Okay, so integrate magnetic flux, right? You integrate this magnetic flux over these 2 cycles, and you get a bunch of flux contacts. So it's 1. Right. Number of flux quanta equals number of independent 2 cycles, non-trivial 2 cycles. And in our second example, this is a whopping 22,722. Okay. Now, one way that fluxes cheaply remove moduli is the fact that they also carry D3 charge. Okay. Pretty much anything you turn on in string theory can carry charges, and fluxes are no exception. And the charge, the D3 charge that you get from them is equal to this thing, F3, integral of F3, which H3 integrated over X, minus 1/2 integral of F2, which F2 integrated over the D7. Okay, this is topological quantity, purely determined in terms of the flux quanta. So that means our D3 charge cancellation condition gets modified to minus L plus number of D3 brains. That had to be 0 before, but now we just get this stuff as well. Integral over x, f3, h3, minus 1.
57.
And it turns out, so in general, this can be positive or negative, but it turns out that for fluxes that satisfy the classical equation of motion, or for supersymmetric fluxes at least, that the contribution to the free brain charge is positive, as you might expect. In any case, just from this formula, you see that that really, you can imagine, replacing this MD3 just by contributions from here. Okay, and so this indeed turns out to be the case. So we can take number of the free brain terms exactly zero by some suitable choice of flux. So this eliminates, of course, the trivial way, the D3 module. If you want the D3 brain sort of dissolve into the flux.
And they don't happen.
Okay, well, this already gets rid of about 3,000 moduli, if we can put it off. Secondly, so one. Secondly, these fluxes induce, well, a potential, as I said. And more precisely, well, you can describe this in the n equals 1 supergravity framework. As follows, so you get in fact, so in n equals 1 supergravity, you can write a potential, this F term potential as coming from superpotential. And the superpotential has a, well, in principle, explicit description in string theory. It depends on the axiom dilaton on this thing here. It depends on the complex structure moduli, and it depends on the D-set moduli. And okay, it has some nice expression. It looks something like this. So if these are the flux quanta of F3, right, I label them by F3i, then the superpotential is linear in this flux quanta, and the flux quanta multiplies something what's known as Calabi-Yau period. These are some sort of generalized hybrid geometric functions you get by integrating the holomorphic freeform of the Calabi-Yau over 3 cycles. But since I didn't really introduce this holomorphic freeform, there's not much point in writing down the formula. In any case, this is just something which can be computed in principle. It can be complicated, but it can be computed. There's an algorithm for it. And similarly, for the NS part. Okay. Oh, and here there's an additional tau. Oops. Okay. I goes to 1 to the number of 3 cycles. And then we have F2 alpha. These are the flux quanta of F2. And again, there's a certain kind of chain periods, as they're called, which depend on the complex structure moduli and the D7 brain moduli. You get it by integrating the holomorphic free form over certain 3 chains which end on the D7 brains. Kind of a complicated mess, but in principle, can be computed, even though that would produce a lot of endorphins. But anyway, I guess we would Right, so in any case, the upshot is the general structure of the superpotential is flux quanta, flux quanta vector, times some complicated function of various point time, okay? With some something linear in the flux quanta, times something. Okay, and in particular, it is independent of the Cayley moduli they don't appear anywhere. And well, in the case we still have the three moduli left, it's also independent of those.
So it's not general and get these
well, you can, but not for every flux will you get rid of it, right? So it's so it depends on the choice of flux quanta. You see, once you can, so in principle, this gives you some quadratic, integral quadratic bilinear form, depending on the flux quanta. Okay, so this is some integral number. But depending which flux quanta you choose, sometimes you will exactly saturate the tadpole without any equilibrium charge, but sometimes you will also have to have to. So, whatever the superpotential is, the general rules of n equals 1 supergravity tell you that the superpotential then gives rise to a potential proper, which looks like e to the Cayley potential. I didn't say what the Cayley potential is in this case. Again, there is an explicit expression for it in terms of the volume and again, these so-called periods. So again, if you can compute these, you can also compute the Cayley potential. And the general expression is EW squared minus 3. Okay, this is standard supergravity expression for the Cayley, for the potential in terms of the superpotential. And then, well, this is kind of special to these compactifications at tree level. You can rewrite this in this way, where d prime is all derivatives, well, all it's actually Cayley covariant derivatives, right? But without derivatives with respect to the Cayley and also the D3 moduli. Okay? So it's precisely what remains is precisely the derivatives with respect to the moduli that appear here. So it turns out that derivatives or the covariant derivatives, right, the D is actually dz would be dz plus dz, okay, right? Scalar covariant derivatives. Turns out that the contributions to this from derivatives, covariant derivatives with respect to the moduli that do not appear in the superpotential are exactly such that they cancel with this term. Right? That's what you've learned. Okay. Yeah, there's an inverse scalar metric here that's I've hidden that in these little bars, so there is like a bit, it's G, A, B bar, B, A, W, B, B bar, W bar. That's this thing. Yeah. So being a bit schematic. And this you can also write as e to the k if you plug in those things, so you get some flux quanta d prime. Fine, and see. Okay. So note that this looks very much like our toy model that I gave in the first lecture. Yeah. So it's a similar structure, linear in the fluxes, multiplying something else. Only this is, of course, quite a lot more complicated. But the general structure remains the same, and in fact also the general consequences about the discrete term and so on that you get in this case. So note that just from requiring derivatives of B with respect to the Kähler moduli to vanish, if you write it this way, well, you see the only place where the Kähler moduli appear is in this prefactor. Even though I didn't give the Kähler potential explicitly, they definitely appear there. They have to, otherwise it would be no metric, for the Kähler moduli. But they don't appear here. Okay. So that means, okay, you vary this factor, and that's this prefactor has some critical point itself, which it doesn't have, it turns out, then the only way that this can be satisfied, derivatives V with respect to the size moduli is zero, is if D prime W equals zero. Okay, so this follows from the equations of motions with respect to the size moduli. Yeah. So what does this mean? Well, you see here, we just have a sort of a critical point condition, right? And in particular, it means that the number of equations here equals the number of unknowns, right? So W depends on the D7 rate moduli, the delta maximum, and the complex structure moduli. We have derivatives with respect to each of those here. So you get exactly as many equations as you have unknowns. And so generically, you just expect isolated solutions. In other words, you expect that these equations of motion freeze the complex structure D7 and Dilaton action moduli. So this is, you expect generically, of course, in this case, it's just impossible, at least by brute force methods, to construct those explicitly. But okay, you can look at simpler examples, like toroidal cases and so on, which have many less factors, many less possibilities, many less fluxes. And in those simple examples, you can find explicit solutions, which builds some confidence that these genericity arguments may be correct. I have to stress, though, that this has not been really proven, right? But it is a genericity argument. The things are not completely generic due to the tuple cancellation and so on. All right. Another approach is a more statistical approach, like I outlined in the toy model. And so there you can, in fact, prove that at least in the limit that you just let, you know, L grow large, which of course you cannot, but okay, you can hope that it's still a good approximation for smaller values of L2. You can show without having to compute any actual vacua, you can show just statistical methods. You can show, so they are valid for large L Yeah, it's, and you know, the reasoning goes very, very analogous to what we did in the toy model. It's like slightly more involved, but it just can be done. And basically, it amounts to counting lattice points in some effective sphere by computing the volume of that sphere. Okay, the effective sphere will be determined by the temporal cancellation condition. So you want NB3 to be positive. So that means that what you have here, this thing, has to be less than or equal to L. Okay. So that's very similar to this toy model of temporal cancellation condition that I gave. And okay, well, you can do the computation, and what comes out is that the number of flux factor, not surprisingly perhaps, in retrospect, is roughly, so the total number of flux factor you get from that equation, d prime w equals 0, is pi l d over 2, d over 2 factorial, exactly the volume of a sphere of radius square root l in d dimensions, where d is the number of fluxes that one turns on. And L is V3 temporal, right? I mean, okay. So this is a very useful formula. Okay. And so, let me give you an example. So in example 2, okay, if we only turn on the RR and SNS fluxes, yeah, then D equals 2 times 300 equals 600. Yeah, or L is still 1944. Yeah. So you can just plug it into this formula, and you find for the total number of flux factor 10 to the 520. This is where this famous number comes from. Perspective. So we have only turned on RR and SNS fluxes. So this is like, basically, these are the closed groups, if you want the closed spring sector fluxes. But we have more of them, right? Remember? So there are more fluxes there, in particular the world volume fluxes on the D7 grain. Yeah. So if we also turn on those, turn on the world volume fluxes F2. Okay. So then, well, we get a total number of fluxes D, total dimension of the flux, that is, becomes now with the numbers I gave you, times out of everything, you get 23,322 in the example. L is still 1944, of course, it doesn't change. And so you find for the number of vacua, approximately, if you still trust this formula, 10 to the 1,700. Okay. Now, it must be said, though, that here you're, in fact, outside of regime of trust or validity of the counting formula. So one has to be a little bit cautious, and maybe being outside of that regime could even mean that, for example, maybe it's turns out that the genericity argument is not correct, and then you will always have still some unstabilized moduli. At this point, is well, not much evidence for this or the opposite. But in any case, it kind of looks like this produces a lot of flux factor. Now I'm actually out of time. Okay, so let me do this in Julia. So the final thing would have been the stabilizing Kähler moduli, because you just erase this. Oh, no, here it is. So you see, okay, the superpotential, this flux superpotential, and so on, these fluxes stabilize all the complex section moduli, these 7 range moduli, and the delta vector. Fine. If you plug this back into here, you find that for the remaining moduli, namely the Kähler moduli, perhaps the pre-Bayes moduli, the potential again becomes exactly flat, right? V equals zero. So the Kähler moduli are not stabilized at all by this mechanism at V level. So you have to do more, and well, only able to explain this, but. This would be and so there's basically two scenarios. There's a KKLT scenario and then a slight variant of this BBCQ. Okay. This is Patrick Conner-Felina and Trivedi. This is Bozzi Bramanian, Bertrand Conner-Trivedo. So in 1 minute, what's the basic idea? Well, classically, they don't get stabilized. So you have to look at quantum corrections. And they could come in the form of instanton corrections to the superpotential or perturbative corrections to the Kähler potential. So it's the non-perturbative corrections W and then perturbative and non-perturbative, if you want, corrections to the Kähler potential. Okay. Now these are absolutely essential. So without these, there's no hope you can do it in any controlled regime. So these non-perturbative corrections come from the three instantons, as they're called, or from the 7 Gitchino condensation. Okay, whatever the upshot is, they give corrections to the superpotential that are of this form. Okay, where T is some given by the volume of some 4 cycle complexified by some integral by some x cube. Okay, so these are the form of instanton corrections, and the whole observation of Katrin Kalashlin and Trivedi was that if you can tune the fluxes such that the flux contribution to the superpotential is extremely small, which by statistical arguments you can show you can indeed do, then you will get a critical point of this quantum corrected superpotential where the Kähler modulus or Kähler moduli gets stabilized at reasonably large volume. This gives you a supersymmetric ADS critical point, and then they also pointed out, okay, so this is a supersymmetric ADS critical point with a very small negative cosmological constant. Yeah. And then they pointed out that you can also uplift this to some positive cosmological constant, space-time, by tuning fluxes again such that you get like some large warping part of the clavia, putting an anti-D3 brain at the bottom of that throat. Again, using statistical methods, you can show that this is indeed possible. So you get a very tiny uplift in this wave. And the whole negative discrete term of cosmological constants that you had in the supersymmetric case gets lifted to a discrete term, which includes a region very close to zero. And in that way, you know, statistically, that one of the vacuum will have, you know, custom for it, at least, well, like, probably many of the vacua, if you have numbers of this size, 10 to the 500, 10 to the 1,000, that have cosmological constants that are 10 to the minus 120 or much less. Okay, you would not be able to find which vacuum exactly has this, and it would be very sensitive to quantum correction, so it's completely hopeless to, it's going to figure out which of the vacua would correspond to having one with such a tiny cosmological constant. But just statistically, you know, there is this discrete term, right? It's very, very dense set of values of the cosmological constant. So just statistically, some of them will have an extremely small value. Okay? So that was the inside of KPLP, which, you know, spark this whole landscape industry within string theory. The other scenario, EBCQ, is just a variant of that where instead of supersymmetrically stabilizing the Kähler moduli, there's like some nifty trick where you can balance the some perturbative correction to the Kähler potential against one non-perturbative correction in the superpotential. And that then gives rise to volume, stabilized volumes that can be very, very large. So it's in fact somewhat better controlled than the KKLT scenario where the volumes tend to be kind of smallish. And so that construction looks reasonably well controlled, and then you could uplift it. But unfortunately, I was too optimistic about time. Anyway, there's many review papers. The original KKLT paper is also pretty readable. So if you want, you can just look at that with everything you know now. And that's it. Thank you.